Well, I don't know how you do a wrap up in like 20 minutes for 2 hours of discussion, but I will try. No, what I found is that you guys had some really good discussion groups going on today. You talked about a lot of practical things, things you can take home and implement in your own personal life, as well as things that you can take home and implement in your CYCs and Ecclesia, which is really good. It's nice to have a blend of those items. What I want to do for at least for a few minutes is take you back through how the development of the timeline comes along for people that have looked into this period of the judges. And this isn't just my stuff. This is things that we compile over years of doing studies of judges and Samuel and other people that you can look at folks that have researched this topic and tried to figure out how do you fit these things together. So one of the critical things that you look at first was a nice chart they had in your workbook about looking at how the judges were scattered all throughout the land. If you've never seen that before, there's a tendency to think that they were all like centrally located and were supposed to influence the whole land, but that is not the case. God scattered the judges all over the place, so it depends on what influences you are having. So Jephthah is dealing with Amorites over here, Gideon's dealing with the Midianites, and so on. There were different groups of people that came in and influenced. But what that allows you to realize also is that it's possible that one judge could be doing something up here in the north while another one is doing something here in the south, and there is a possibility of overlapping of the judges, which if you've never looked at that idea of overlap before, that may be new to you. Where this comes from is what I think is a mistranslation of using maybe Greek texts that weren't quite as accurate on the King James and New King James Bibles. Either one, I tend to use a New King James, but either one of them made the mistake in Acts 13 when the Apostle Paul was giving a recount of what God did in the past. He stood up and talked to the people, and he talked about how God chose our fathers, so that would have been back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, exalted the people when they dwelt in Egypt, and then he brought them out of there, and he put up with them for the 40 years in the wilderness, and then he destroyed the seven nations in Canaan and distributed their land to them by allotment, which takes you through the period of Joshua. And then verse 20 says, after that, he gave them judges for about 450 years until Samuel the prophet. That is what has fooled people for years on this timeline. If you look at some of the, well, here's an example, like the CSS thing they put out on the chronology of the book of the Judges, they've got down here the total from the death of Joshua to Samson is 450 years because everybody thought that that's what that passage actually meant. If you look at some of the newer versions, though, that are using older Greek texts, it actually says, it gives a summary here of what Paul says, what God did from Abraham all the way up to the period when Joshua distributed the land as an inheritance, all of which took about 450 years. After these things, he gave them judges until Samuel the prophet. So the 450 years does not apply to the period of the judges. That's the first thing you have to figure out. Now, we knew that was true without this being fixed, just by the fact that Jephthah says, and you're looking at Jephthah back in Judges, whatever it is, 11, Jephthah says when his argument to the Amorites is that, look, you guys are all worried about us, you know, taking your land, you know, and we have your land. And Jephthah says to them, look, don't you remember, it's been 300 years since Moses took the land from the Amorites and took it for us. So we know that from the period of Moses taking the Amorite land, when they came up at the end of the 40 years, when they came up on the eastern side, when Moses took the Amorite land from them and then took the eastern side, that from that period to Jephthah is 300 years. And then from Jephthah to the end of Judges is no way 150 years. So, and plus you got to knock out Joshua's time as well. So everybody has known that the period of the judges did not really last 450 years. So when you look at some of the chronologies that people have experienced and put together, who put all these pieces together, it's pretty common knowledge out there on the internet that when you look around and try to figure out where all this fits in, the period of the judges is probably somewhere just over 300 years total, 300 years. Which means then that you can allow for some of this overlapping, that it doesn't mean that one judge had to come after the other. Now, at the very beginning, they did, because when you recall what happened at the very beginning, the first judge would be raised up, and he would do his job, and then you'd have a phrase at the end. The land had rest for so many years, right? And then the next judge comes along after the next cycle goes on. But then all that quits after a while. And as you're going through the judges, you get up to the period of Jephthah, and there's no more land had rest at all. It's just one thing leads to another and another, and some of them were probably happening simultaneously. So what you end up with then is that here's Jephthah right in here, and we know it's only 300 years from him all the way back to the period of Joshua back here and Moses taking the Amorites' land. Therefore, when you go to fit all this in and get up all the time period of Saul right there, you don't have any 450 years. So what people have done is try to look at, all right, where do the overlaps occur? Not necessarily at the beginning, but probably more so near the end, where you've got Jephthah and Ibzan and Elon and Abdon all interacting over here in this period where Eli's around and Samuel and Samson are all in here at the same time, which is really fascinating because what that allows for is the possibility that Jephthah made a vow. And what was his vow? What was Jephthah's vow? Yeah, whoever walked out first after he came back victorious, he'd dedicate to God. Now, I don't think he killed his daughter myself. I don't believe that story. I think he dedicated her like a burnt offering. He dedicated her to the house of God. And so Jephthah's daughter went to work in the temple, and she was probably there in the temple in the time of Eli. And that makes me feel a lot better about Hannah dropping off Samuel. If I was Hannah, I would drop off Samuel to somebody like Jephthah's daughter. And that may be what actually happened, and other women like her. So you end up with possibilities of things overlapping in these periods here that otherwise you would think were like spread out so long that they couldn't have possibly interacted. So another one that comes up when you start looking at creating the timeline, we know right here that we are just looking at today that Samson will begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. All right, Philistines' domination is 40 years, 40 years. So if somebody's told, if you were told that your son is going to begin to deliver these people from the hand of the Philistines, would you think that like the Philistines are already in power now? Yeah, and he's going to begin to deliver them? Now, do you think this is going to be like as soon as the Philistines took over, he's going to begin to deliver when they dominated for 40 years? No. You'd probably think that some period of years has been going by, and then he's going to begin the deliverance, which is probably somewhere at least the second half of the 40 years, not the beginning of the 40 years of the Philistine domination. Probably. Another mistake that came up is when you look at, and this is how timelines get confusing. This is the one about the ark that we're going to get into last day. Second to the last day, somewhere in here. We're going to get to this period in 1 Samuel 7. When the men of Kiriath Jearim came to take up the ark, and they brought it to the house of Abinadab on the hill, they consecrated Eleazar to have charge of the ark of the Lord. From the day that the ark was lodged at Kiriath Jearim, a long time passed, some 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Now, I looked at that for a long time doing my Bible readings, thinking that meant the ark was in the house of Abinadab for 20 years. Is that true? Well, I guess 20 years is true. Was it there for only 20 years? Ever thought of that? How long was the ark in the house of Abinadab? Now, when did this happen? When did it actually make it to the house of Abinadab? Why wasn't the ark in Shiloh where it belonged? What happened? Got to think. The Philistines, right? So they took it into the Israelites took it into battle. The Philistines captured it. The ark was taken over to the coastland of the Philistines from one city to another. Finally, God took care of his ark, and they put it on a cart and sent it back. It ended up where? In Beth Shemesh, right? And the Jews in Beth Shemesh, what'd they do? They looked at it like the Philistines had, and God struck a bunch of them, and then we don't want this thing. And so they sent it over to Kiriath Jearim, and it got put into the house of Abinadab, and nobody wanted the ark. It got left there. For how long? How long do you think it was there? You're talking about right now from the time when, you know, the Philistines took it when Saul died, right? All the way through this period then to where you end up having, when Eli died, all the way through the period of Samuel, when he anoints Saul, Saul's king, and all the way through to where finally, who brings the ark out of there? David, you're looking at like 60, 70, 80 years, maybe 90 years later when finally the ark is taken out of the house of Abinadab. So this 20 years right here is only the period from the death of Eli, when the ark got over to the Philistines for like 7 months. It ends up in the house of Abinadab now. And now you're dealing, this is like the first 20 years that that ark was at the house of Abinadab. That's the first 20 years that we're talking about. So we know that the ark was there for some 20 years before Samuel finishes the deliverance of Israel from the Philistine domination. Because 1 Samuel 7, what does he do? You know, people are finally lamenting over the issue. Samuel calls them together, and what do they do? What do? They go fight the Philistines. And it says there that finally the Philistine domination was ended, and they no more came into Israel's land during the life of Samuel, right? So the end of the 40-year domination occurs right here in 1 Samuel 7, after the 20 years that the ark had been in the house of Abinadab. So here's what you do. You start to put the pieces together on the timeline. So in Judges 13, we know the Philistine domination was 40 years, and we know that Samson judged Israel for 20 years. We're going to find that out in Judges 16. So you've got this 40-year period of the Philistine domination. We also know that the ark was there for 20 years before the end of the Philistine domination, because this, at the end of these 20 years right here, this is when Samuel gathers everybody together in 1 Samuel 7, and finally they go end the Philistine domination. So you can backtrack 20 years right here through this 40-year period, and we know that halfway through here, what had to happen? What had to happen that caused the ark to leave in the first place? This is when the battle took place where Eli died, his sons died, and now Samuel really is the one who's taking over as priest there at the time. So this is the period then when Eli had to die right at that point right there. So we know that Eli judged Israel for 40 years. So you can go back, actually this should go back even further. So here's Eli's death. He would actually go back all the way to somewhere back in here. So we know that he was around for probably at least 20 years before the Philistine domination occurred. And these are the kind of things you put together. After Eli now, then we can put Samuel in, and we know that Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. So the only thing you're left with then is, where do you fit in Samson? Where does he fit in into this 40-year domination right here? Now we know that he began to deliver Israel. He began. It makes to me no sense to think that the Philistines started to dominate right here and Samson begins his deliverance 5 years later and he began to deliver Israel and then they were under the Philistines for 35 more years? I don't think so. That's probably not the case. So, and then when you start putting together the pieces about how did Samson ever get the people in 1 Samuel 7, how did Samuel get the people to rally behind him? And finally, let's go out and take care of the Philistines, as if it wasn't as a result of some major event that occurred that caused the nation to really wonder what's going on. And the death of Samson would have done that. And so you put these pieces together and realize then that probably Samson's period then is somewhere here right up to the end. We know he began around 20 years old and maybe 18 or 20 when he began judging, and he judged Israel for 20 years. So you're sort of stuck with the fact that Samson's 20 years are probably somewhere in this range right here, and exactly how they overlap, we really don't know. But that's got to be somewhere in that period. So we ended up putting a chart together some years ago that looked something like this, where you end up with this period, and we don't know exactly how these things fit. But I think the only thing you can do with Samson's judging right there is you can put it there or you can move it back even further a little bit. But Samson is somewhere in this period right in here where he begins the deliverance of Israel and Samuel finishes it right there. And so we know that this is the period right here when Samuel's in 1 Samuel 7 takes place. And that's after the ark has been in Kiriath-Jearim for 20 years. That's how people put together this timeline and come up with the overlap, if that's bothered you a whole lot. But there again, I wouldn't sit there and worry about this. This is my crazy math background. When I do Bible study, I always have to develop timelines because I always try to fit the math together to see how it all works. And that's what happens if you have one of those crazy brains that thinks mathematically all the time. Anyways, I like timelines. Now, I think one of the great things, though, that you get out of this whole period from the lessons today is that you're going to see with Samson is that, you know, Romans 8, I love the way Paul brings together all these problems about trials. You talked a lot about trials in your classes today, about how God uses trials in a positive way. I'm very thankful that angels are involved in deciding the trials for my family and for my kids and my ecclesia, because I probably wouldn't be strong enough spiritually to bring the troubles into people's lives that it takes to win them over. And angels will do that. They make the tough decisions, the hard decisions, to bring trouble and frustration into people's lives because they know the long-term good that it's going to bring. But when Paul was talking about the family of God in Romans 8, you know, this is a passage we quote a lot, but we got to learn to really believe it. That, you know, we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to his purpose. Because God's got this whole plan. He sees the big picture and he knows what it takes to get us to the end. And he sends the angels out to take care of this. And they make these tough calls, these tough decisions. They bring troubles into our life. And it doesn't matter whether the troubles were caused by some bad decision that I made, like Samson, or whether the troubles were just the result of God just bringing them into your life, and God could cause them. Angels can do things in our life. Or it could be that somebody else brings trouble into your life, and they did it for the wrong reason, like Joseph's brothers. It doesn't matter. What Paul brings out is the overriding principle that in all these things, God is in such control, he can use even the worst motives of other people to still bring about good. And that's the conviction we have. That's our faith about our God. And I think you saw that as you were going through some of these things with Samson. That, you know, in the midst of all this trouble, God can still use that to bring about some good things. So there were a lot of good lessons that everybody brought up today. And I started compiling them earlier on. But, you know, in the end, I think some of the practical ones that you want to take home to your family and your ecclesia, is you had some really good lessons about things that you can do yourself, about the Nazarite vow of separation to God, how everybody has the opportunity in ecclesial life, whether you're arranging brethren, arranging sister, rearranging sister, or whatever, you have the opportunity to still walk amongst your CYC and your ecclesia like a Nazarite and raise the level of spiritual awareness in people's lives by how you live. What happens when you go home is everybody's going to watch to see how you live, not so much what you say. And when you get married and have kids, if you do, that's exactly what your kids do. That's what you've been doing with your parents. You watch to see how they live, not just what they say, because how they live is worth a lot more than what they say. And it's important you go home and put these things into practice. But when you go home to your COICs, we talked about some of these things in one of the discussion groups this morning. It's really good to bring up some of these things that can influence your future. Somebody asked a great question this morning about, well, what can we do to prevent us from going down these bad pathways? What can you do when you go home? Because when God brings prosperity into our life, which he does in these cycles that the judges are going through, and he gives them rest for a while, inevitably, when the people have rest, they just choose to do bad things. And then God has to bring more suffering back into their life. So how can we prevent that from happening in our life? And what we used to do at our COIC is we bring up all these critical things as subjects that we discuss every year, every couple of years. But it would be things like, well, who are you going to marry? Where are you looking for a spouse? Who do you go dating? These are decisions that you make that have long-term consequences about your life, your spiritual life. Your spouse can either help you in the truth or they can be a drag on you all through your life. And that's a huge decision that you will be making in the next few years, some of you. You decide where you're going to live. You know, where are you going to live near an ecclesia, a CYC, or are you going to go off on your own? Where are you going to go to school? You're going to go to university. You're going to go off to some place because you want this dream job that you have. You've got to go to this special university to get it. And it could drag your spiritual life down. Or are you going to accept the fact that, oh no, the top priority is to find a place where I can be connected to a CYC, to a Christadelphian community. And the job, God will work out. God will fix all that in the end because he causes everything to work together for good. Those are the kind of things that you can do when you go home to your ecclesias next week in your CYCs and you start planning the fall. Come up with topics like this that challenge people about where you're going to live, what kind of job are you going to have, who are you going to marry, and put those into your schedules so that you can help people make good long-term decisions that will keep them on the straight and narrow way so they won't have to go through the crazy life of Samson of the ups and the downs to the point that you finally God has to pull his eyes out in order for him to finally spiritually see. That's the kind of thing that you can do next week, and that will make a difference in your life as well as the life of your CYC. So I'll leave it there for now. Thanks, Josh. Sorry I spent so long on the timeline, but some of us were bothered by that, and we didn't think it was worth sort of wasting the time in your discussion groups.